and welcome to the CWF Gamecast. Today we have a very special show. I'm delighted to say that I've been looking forward to this for quite a while, actually. We're lucky enough to have Henry Hyde as a special guest. He's the owner and editor of Battle Games Magazine. He champions the British charity Combat Stress. He's also a co-host of the View from the Veranda podcast with Neil Shook, and he blogs as well. Henry, how are you doing today?
Hello there, Jonathan. I'm absolutely fine. Thank you very much indeed. I think we should let our listeners know that you're going beyond the call of duty because you've got a bit of a cold today, haven't you, Jonathan?
Yeah, I'm going to try to plow through that, but we'll see how it goes.
Fantastic. Well, I'm sure we'll get there. But it's a real pleasure at long last to be on your podcast. I've been delighted to be able to sponsor a few competitions and stuff for you. And obviously, I'm happy to, you know, do that whenever you like. So thank you very much for, you know, the publicity that you've let me have as a result of that. And it's a real pleasure to finally get together with you online.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this. And I'm glad you mentioned about the sponsorship. I try to get that out in the beginning of any time we have a guest on who has anything to do with the show. I like to keep things, you know, above board and
absolutely
for the visibility, just so people know. But I got to say, whether you donate stuff or donate stuff, that doesn't alter how I'm going to treat you. I do what I do, but I try to, you know, be even-handed and fair with everything.
Absolutely. Quite correct.
So, Henry, I have some standard questions, I guess you could call them, that I kind of ask anyone who's on the show. If you've ever seen, you know, Inside the Actors Studio on, I don't know, Comedy Central, whatever it's on, they have like this whole formula of, you know, where were you raised and all this kind of stuff, just to kind of cover everything. But then they get into some interesting questions. So I kind of took that as, you know, guidelines, I guess, for how to form my questions. So I'm going to start off with the question I start everyone off with. What, if any, podcast or radio do you listen to?
I listen to yours. And I listen to Meeples and Miniatures. They're the only two podcasts I regularly listen to. It's not because I've got anything against podcasts, because obviously I'm involved with doing some myself. It's simply a matter of time, Jonathan, that I, when I'm working, which is most of the time, it has to be said, because of the nature, the very detailed nature of the work I do, and because I'm working with words, I find listening to either talk radio or podcasts quite distracting. Because I'm a linguist, I pick up on what's being said and I get involved with, you know, what's being said, either agreeing or disagreeing or just thinking about it. And when I'm trying to write in particular or edit stuff, I just find that incredibly distracting. So in fact, most of the time I listen to music, Jonathan. I've always loved music and you know, I play a bit myself, and that's the kind of thing that I find I can just have on in the background and helps, you know, keep a rhythm going and keeps the energy going for what I'm doing. My other half, Annie, bless her heart, she's a great fan of BBC Radio 4, which you may know is, if you like, the premier radio station over here in the UK. It's considered the most sort of, I don't know, intellectual, academic sort of talk radio station. But she designs and makes wedding dresses for a living, so she's not having to worry about being distracted by that. She likes having that on in the background to keep her company. But as I say, when it comes to podcasts, I admire a lot of the podcasting that's being done, but it is a combination of time and distraction. So that's probably the best answer to that, Jonathan.
Well, I understand that, because a lot of shows, like we tend to do an hour-long show, but some of the shows I listen to, like WW News from the Front, they tend to do a very longer show. They're at least an hour, hour and a half, or 2 hours, and it can be kind of tough to find the time to listen to that.
Yeah, it can, and it's also, if you like, one of the it's one of the strengths of amateur podcasting that you can just talk and yak away for hours on end. But I also feel personally that actually a lot of amateur podcasts could learn from the professionals who have, you know, a set slot of 30 minutes, an hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever it is, and stick to that and edit down. Because to be honest, frankly, stuff is often much, much better when it's edited down. I mean, obviously editing is something I do for a living. And so people often would send me an article that initially, I don't know, might fill 10 pages of the magazine. Well, there's no way I can let someone, apart from exceptional circumstances, take up 10 pages of my, you know, 56-page magazine. So, it, you know, my job is to edit down. And you have to be kind of ruthless as you do that. The objective is to try and actually improve the quality. And what you find is that actually, when you're editing, there is quite a lot of waffle and ums and ahs and this and that, or their written equivalents. And I suspect that a lot of the people who, if they've done, say, a three-hour show, I bet that a skilled editor could certainly cut that down to 2 hours. But as you say, it's horses for courses. Some people like it if they're going on a long car journey or a long train journey, something like that, and just having, you know, this conversation going on in the background about their hobby, you know, something that they really like. But I tend to be someone who likes to think, okay, I can spare the 30 minutes, 1 hour, 2 hours, whatever it is, to actually listen to something. And if it drones on beyond that, I do tend to lose interest.
Some of the best podcasts I've listened to back in the day were 15 minutes in length. They covered, yeah, you know, whatever they needed to. They picked a topic, they focused, they did a good job. And then 15 minutes later, you're done. So you could find any time or date really to listen to that.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with that completely.
So you had mentioned that you like to play music while you're working, and that you actually make music yourself. What kind of music do you do?
Well, the kind of stuff I've personally done, well, years and years ago, when I was at school, I was forced to learn the piano by a terrible music teacher who used to slap me across the knuckles if I got a chord wrong. So,
I didn't think they did that.
So the upshot of that was, Jonathan, I took up the trombone, where there's no fingering to worry about. And for years, I played the trombone, and in both classical, and I did some trad jazz and stuff, and big band jazz as well. But that's a long time ago. Ever since I was a wee boy, at school, I don't know if it's the same where you are over in the States, but it certainly is the case over here still, that young children are often introduced to the recorder. You know, the recorder, the little penny whistle thing.
Yep.
And it's one of those instruments that's actually it's good for kids to pick up and learn the basics of music. But also, I discovered there's quite a huge repertoire for the recorder. So actually, I was a reasonably accomplished recorder player, descant, treble and tenor recorder player. And I used to be in a recorder group. And then this is where, being an American, you may have heard of these guys. Do you know about the SCA at all?
I can't say I do.
Right. Well, you can go look this up online, www.sca.org. The SCA, SCA stands for the Society for Creative Anachronism. Now, it's a pretty controversial organization, because over here in the UK in particular, and in mainland Europe, we have lots and lots of medieval reenactment groups who are very, very strict about the time period that's covered. For example, we've got a group over here called the White Company, who reenact the Wars of the Roses, you know, 1485, and that kind of period. And they're very strict about the quality of the armor that you wear, the costume. It's all got to be hand stitched. If there's any buttons on it, they've got to either be hand carved or cast from pewter, and so on and so on and so forth. You know, so they're real kind of museum quality accuracy. Well, if you don't know anything about the SCA, it's fairly amusing, I suppose. Back in the day, I can't remember, something like 1964, 65, I think it was, there were some guys at Berkeley University in California who I imagine must have got very or perhaps been smoked this one evening and got together and say, like, hey, dude, wouldn't it be like cool to be like those English knights? And they started off with the idea of sort of doing medieval knightly tournaments. But of course, they were students, they had no money, so they improvised, and they made wooden swords, and they used ice hockey gloves and armor and that kind of stuff, and made helmets out of, you know, Freon tanks, you know, the calor gas, we would call it over here in the UK, like camping gas tanks, the big ones. And they would cut the bottom off, cut a slit in it, and stick that on their head, and that would be their medieval medieval Great Hill, right? And they would start, you know, wailing on each other with these sticks, and gradually it evolved, and this whole, they picked up on the idea of sort of Shakespearean courtly language and that kind of thing, and would talk to each other in very grand tones. And eventually some people who actually were doing history degrees got involved and said, you know, guys, it wasn't quite like that. And it sort of started to get people more interested in what medieval history really was, but covered a very wide time frame. I mean, they all take anyone who's interested from kind of like the end of the Vikings, the Dark Ages. So let's say, I think it's something like 800 AD, right the way through to the end of the English Civil War, which of course in the 1640s. And so it's this really kind of weird concept where, and I think nowadays it actually is set up as an educational charity. I think that's how it's run. It's got thousands of members worldwide. I mean, it's huge. I think it's in the tens of thousands of people. And the idea is that you kind of research and enact your own persona. So, for example, for me, and I'll come to how I got involved with this, but I'll just explain this first. For me, I, at the time when I got involved with this, was really interested in Germany in the late Renaissance period. And I don't know if you'd mean anything to you, Jonathan, if I said the word Landsknecht. Does that mean anything to you?
No, not off the top of my head.
Right, okay. I mean, this is why I thought I'd kind of explain the basics of this, because I know that you're a guy who's just really coming into and getting involved with historical wargaming, aren't you?
Yes, that's correct.
Right. And, well, a Landsknecht is basically a German mercenary soldier from the late 15th century, early 16th century. So say from about the 1470s through to the 1530s. Okay. That kind of period. And in that time, in Central Europe, particularly in South Germany and in Switzerland, the main weapon, at the time that got used was the pike, right? The 16-foot long stick with a pointy bit at the end. Okay. And these guys became extremely skilled at basically beating all comers, however they were armed, with incredibly large, dense, but fast-moving pike formations, right? And the history of that period, the military history of that period, is actually fascinating, because these guys served in various different kind of armies around the world. I mean, this is where the Swiss started to get their reputation for being mercenary soldiers, and the South Germans too, because they would hire themselves out as entire regiments, sometimes entire brigades of, you know, thousands of guys to the highest bidder, and go on the battlefield and basically run amok, because even, you know, heavy cavalry at the time, the heavily armored knights, couldn't stand up to these massive formations of pikes, you know, so because if you've got guys wielding 16-foot long pikes, a bit like in the ancient times when it was the Macedonians used to do this, but you'd have several rows of pike heads protruding beyond the front rank. And the problem for the enemy is, well, how on earth do you get past that? You know, and until, and at that period still, it, firearms were still, you know, not particularly commonplace. They were just sort of coming to, into their own, and they would start to really start to dominate the battlefield. Well, you'd be familiar with this now because you're a fan of black powder. At the beginning of the black powder era, which starts kind of 1600, 1620, that kind of time. So these amazing guys with pikes and halberds as well, which is like a huge axe on the end of a stick, they would just carve up the opposition, and nothing could stop them for a period of certainly 20 or 30 years. And I got fascinated with this, not just because of this, you know, amazing thing of these guys living in these mountainous countries, and they'd come together and just hire themselves out to the highest bidder and dominate the battlefields of the time, but also because of what they wore, Jonathan. Now, you probably, without realizing it's what you've seen pictures of Landsknechts, because they tend to be guys wearing really brightly... Well, you've played Warhammer, okay?
Yep.
Warhammer Fantasy.
That's correct.
The Empire, right? That the costumes that are worn by the Empire troops in Warhammer Fantasy, those are Landsknechts. So all the puff and slash. So you get like a jacket that's got slashes in it. And what they've done is they pull the lining through. So you get this multicolored appearance.
Kind of like the right? Vatican Guard.
Yes, exactly that. Exactly that, Jonathan. The Vatican Guard are a living remnant of the time of the Landsknechts, because the Vatican Guard are Swiss. So they are a direct descendants from the Swiss pikemen of this period. Okay, so there's a little history lesson for you, by the by. But going back to, I got involved because actually there was, I was at Sussex University, just up the road from where I still live, actually. And I was studying history and was living on campus at the time. It was a beautiful campus here at Sussex. And I met an American guy, funnily enough, from Rhode Island. And he was a member of the SCA. And he was telling me about all these guys that go off and do whole weekends camping and feasting and doing the music and dancing. But the most exciting thing for me at the time, when I was a student and I was probably about, 20 years old at the time, 19, 20 years old, was his description of the fighting. Because every year in Pennsylvania, for example, there is a thing called the Pensick Wars. Now, it's surprising you haven't heard about this, because the Pensick Wars, they get, I'm not kidding, they have field battles with thousands of guys on each side going at one another full tilt, in full armor.
That's in impressive.
It's wonderfully aggressive, Jonathan. In full armor, but in also what makes it really mad, this is in the middle of the summer in Pennsylvania. And I think, you know, on your side of the water, Pennsylvania is pretty notorious for having really hot, humid summers. And there's these guys running around in, you know, full armor, whacking the hell out of one another. But it's terrific fun, because the thing is, if you ignore the fact that they get all these different personas mixed up, so you got, you know, you might be at a feast dressed as, say, an Elizabethan courtier, and you're sitting next to a Viking. And that's kind of weird. And that's why, if you like, the purists, the historical purists say, oh, this is rubbish, rubbish, rubbish. But what they forget is that actually what's going on is each of those individual people, even though they're from, you know, they're representing completely different actual historical periods, they may be incredibly knowledgeable and have researched what they're wearing and what they're doing and everything. In amazing detail. I mean, I've met so many talented people through the SCA. They, you know, they make their own armor. They make their own weapons. They make their own costumes. The thing I was quite well known for doing was calligraphy. I did a lot of scrolls using the original techniques on vellum and that kind of stuff. That they research and play and dance to the music of the period using period musical instruments. So I think it's, you know, it's a bit rich for people to just dismiss it simply because over the top of that is this sense of fun, if you like, where people are prepared to, if you like, turn a blind eye to the fact that to an outsider, it can look very peculiar indeed. I mean, there's no question about it. But the fighting is tremendous, because you're probably familiar, Jonathan, with reenactors who dress up in armor, yes, and they use real weapons, steel weapons.
Yeah, quite a few of my friends do, like Civil War and American Rev type of reenactment.
Right, okay. Well, the thing about that, I mean, that's great, that's wonderful, but of course, the thing you cannot do when you're using steel replica weapons is actually hit one another.
That's true.
Right? Because if you did it at full force, you'd kill someone, right? So what the really great thing about the SCA is that sometime years ago, back in the late 60s, someone realized, well, okay, we cannot afford to endanger our other members, but we are genuinely interested in medieval combat as a martial art. And there are many treatises that you can find, especially online nowadays. There are many treatises you can find about the use of the broadsword, the longsword, the greatsword, you know, two swords, halberds, pikes, spears, as well as slightly later Renaissance-style fencing, using rapiers, that kind of stuff. There's a huge amount of material out there. And the thing with the SCA is they use wooden weapons, wooden and padded weapons. And the wood they use is rattan. Now, you may be familiar with rattan. It's like the garden furniture bamboo stuff, solid bamboo, basically. And the great thing about rattan is actually you can create a weapon that weighs pretty much exactly the same as a genuine medieval weapon would weigh. That's the first thing. And the second thing is you can hit people full force with it. And because it's slightly flexible, and also if it breaks, it doesn't splinter like oak or heavy wooden weapons. It shreds. You know, it just ends. If you break your weapon, you get a bit of a limp end, you know, and it looks silly, but no one's been hurt. That's the main thing. So what it's enabled the SCA to do is hold tournaments where nothing whatsoever is choreographed and people are hitting each other at what would be, if it was a steel weapon, killing force. Right? Now, once or twice over the course of the years I was doing this, I got a few bruises. Actually, the most dangerous thing was rabbit holes. To be honest, I saw a couple of people get badly sprained and a couple of broken ankles from, you know, doing this in the middle of a field and not spotting a rabbit hole and, you know, hurting their ankle. But, you know, there's been no deaths, no major injuries ever in the SCA as a result of doing their combat, which is, you know, that's quite an achievement, particularly when, as I say, you consider that one of the things that people like to do is hold mass field battles. So it's not just one against one. You'll have skirmishes of maybe, you know, 10 or a dozen aside, and you have bigger battles, 30, 40, 50 aside, and then what we call the wars, where there are literally hundreds or even thousands of people aside. And it's complete mayhem, and it's one of the most wonderful things. So what I would suggest, Jonathan, I'm going to stop talking about the SCA now, but after the show, you go away and look up www.sca.org, and probably on YouTube, you will find videos. If you put in Pensic, that's P-E-N-N-S-I-C, Pensic Wars, you will find videos taken by SCA members at the Pensic Wars of the field battles, and you will see what I mean, and you will just go, oh my god, it is totally for real, totally extraordinary. And the way it's organized, very briefly, is because the SCA has so many members worldwide now, they divide the world up into kingdoms, and the United States has in itself, oh my goodness me, I think there's about four or five kingdoms the USA is divided up into. Canada, I think, has got two. Australia, Europe, mainland Europe. And it's spread to the UK and Europe because, of course, of American service personnel who had been stationed in, you know, Fort Benning in Georgia or whatever, and had their own SCA group, you know, in the military camp, and then they're posted overseas and kind of exported it to us. So there you are, Jonathan.
That actually kind of reminds me of two things. One, you might be familiar. Well, you might be familiar with both of them, actually. There's a movie that came out maybe 6 or 8 years ago, I guess, called Role Models. It was a comedy kind of thing, not a very good movie, but one of the characters in it was really into live-action role-playing. But it was, you know, medieval kind of role-playing, very similar to what you're describing with the SCA. And at the end of the film, it has this whole, like, gigantic battle that's played out. All these people come. They come in their period dress with the period uniforms and, you know, weaponry and everything. And they go and they engage in combat. But then it also reminds me of just live-action role-playing in general, or LARPing. Because a few of my friends do this. They do, I think it's Tales of Valor, it's called Tav. And so, like, some of them wear, like, Roman armor and, you know, use Roman weaponry. Others are more of a, like, a Saxon or a Viking kind of background. And they go and, obviously, it's pretty ahistorical. But they learn about the tactics, about the armor, the creation of it all and stuff. And they actually, my friends, they formed a war band, I guess is probably the best way to describe it. Yeah. And so they go to these events as a war band, but they hold practices weekly. They get together for like a few hours to practice the tactics, to learn about stuff. And there's like, you know, this whole storylines and stuff involved with it, as there is with any sort of role-playing game. But there's, like, you can make stuff. You have to make your own weapons. And they're made out of, you know, foam and, like, PVA pipes and stuff like that. Yeah. So they've kind of learned a little bit of the techniques for creating, you know, what they need to use. And so it has a historical foundation, I guess. And they've just kind of grown out of it.
Yeah, there are many people I know who were in the SCA who also do live action role play, LARPing. And the difference is with LARPing, of course, they're often dealing with much younger kids. SCA combat, you have to be at least 16 years old before you can do the fully armored combat. With LARPing, of course, you sometimes dealing with, well, kids, basically. And so they have to be much, much more safety conscious. So, as you say, the type of weapons you're describing that they use, that we call them boffer weapons.
Yep.
So they use plastics and foams and that kind of stuff. I mean, I have seen many that are amazing creations. They look absolutely, you know, fantastically realistic. But the other thing is, of course, when you get to LARPing, of course, you're talking about, if you like, live Dungeons and Dragons, really. So you get people who have different levels of achievement and so forth. So you can get some really funny instances where, you know, someone runs up and does a brilliant shot and, you know, hits someone straight on the head with their great big sword or whatever. But then that person can turn around and say, oh, no, I'm a level 8 magician and I've just, you know, deflected the blow, which wouldn't go down well in an SCA event. Because basically, if you don't genuinely block the blow using proper fighting techniques, you're a dead'un. It's as simple as that. So, but yes, it's good fun. But yeah, LARPing is something that's never quite appealed to me. I used to do Dungeons and Dragons and Hero Quest. I don't know if you remember Hero Quest.
I have Hero Quest.
Advanced Hero Quest, and I loved that, and still do it from time to time. But yeah, that's as far as my kind of role playing in that sense went. But there you go.
You were talking about your workflow earlier, and I mean, you're talking about the SCA and everything, kind of it shapes your worldview, I guess. But you have a lot of different projects going on in your life.
Well spotted, Jonathan.
How about I don't know, pick one. Let's start with whatever one you like and just tell us about it.
Oh, crank. Well, now you choose one, Jonathan, because I wouldn't know where to start.
Obvious one is battle games, but you have like your book that's going to be coming out, which is available for pre-order on Amazon, although you've said it's not done yet, so I don't know how Amazon did that. But, I mean, you have all sorts of different things. You design box art for, you know, plastics, and you mentioned about doing editing for books, and you have your fingers in many different pies.
Yeah, I think the expression you're looking for, Jonathan, is know-it-all.
I prefer jack of all trades myself. But...
Thank you very much. What I prefer is Renaissance man, Jonathan. I prefer Renaissance man. The fact of the matter is that I, just as a human being, I've always been interested in many different things. Some would probably justifiably say too many different things. I'm sure my life would have been much easier if I'd just been completely focused on one thing since I was a youngster and just kind of went for it. But the fact of the matter is I'm interested in a huge number of things. A typical Gemini personality is what some people say as well. But it's true. I mean, I've already mentioned I'm interested in music. I'm interested in literature. I'm interested in art, illustration. I'm interested in design. I'm interested in you name it. I don't know. Perhaps I should give you a bit of a CV that would help you to understand how this has come about, Jonathan.
That sounds good.
I went to a grammar school here in the UK. I mean, it's a public school, it's not a private school. I went to a good quality school when I was young, and I got very interested, particularly in history and English and languages, whilst I was at school. And then I went to the University of Sussex, which is actually just a few miles up the road from where I'm sitting right now, although I didn't live in this part of the country at the time. I lived somewhere else. So I came to Sussex University, and I did a degree in in those days, it was called European Studies Brackets History with German. So Sussex University was one of the first universities in the UK to have what are called contextual courses, which basically means you study your core subject, in my case was European history, but also around that to give you a kind of more rounded worldview. I did some philosophy, some politics, some economics, some linguistics. I also did a course learning Italian, and it gives you, puts the idea is that you learn your history, but it puts it in the context of what else is going on culturally around that core subject. And it was fascinating. It was brilliant. I thoroughly enjoyed my degree. I spent my third year studying abroad in Germany, a place called Augsburg, not far from Munich. And so it meant I got to use my language skills for real, whilst also learning history at a German university. And of course, made lots of German friends. And as anyone will tell you who's lived abroad, just learning to cope with living abroad is an extraordinary challenge and great experience. So then I came back to the UK and graduated. And like most people with a European history degree, you then go, what am I going to do now? Because I didn't necessarily want to go into teaching straight away or anything like that. So I did various different jobs. The first job I had after graduating, I worked as a menswear assistant, Jonathan, in a shop here in town. And then I went off and I was a tour guide, taking coachloads of people around holiday destinations in Europe. Then I worked in, oh my goodness me, then I worked in life insurance. Then I worked in the print trade. Then I worked in the travel trade again. Then I worked in life insurance again. And finally, I ended up, this was kind of the late 1980s, you may have heard the term yuppie, which was stood for young, upwardly mobile professional. In other words, I was financially doing quite well, and I was in a job that was very kind of financially driven. I was a life insurance sales manager. And then I discovered my boss was a crook.
Oh, wow.
And I literally threw my resignation on his desk and walked out. And then I thought, oh my God, what have I done? I've got a 100% mortgage. I've got car loans. I've got this loan and that loan. It was crikey. Suddenly I was under a lot of financial pressure. Let's put it that way. And I was fed up with working in financial services. This had left a really bad taste in my mouth. All the way through all those other jobs I'd done, Jonathan, I had always been a drawing, painting, designing things for people, even though at the time I didn't really realize that's what I was doing. And I'd also, as I think I mentioned in amongst all that, I'd worked in the print trade, and I met graphic designers on a, you know, daily basis in that time. But that was in the old days before there were computers, Jonathan. There was no Adobe Photoshop. There was no Adobe InDesign. There was no Quark Express. There was none of that kind of stuff. And graphic designers used to, I don't know how much you know about graphic design in the old days, but they used to have to do all sorts of complicated things to produce their artwork literally on boards, an art board that would show two kind of A4 size, or you would say US letter size, pages up side by side, if it was a brochure. And they would literally have had to print out the text and stick it down onto these boards along with the pictures and stuff. And that was literally then photographed on a huge great camera. And it was from that they then made the plates that went onto the printing presses and so on. So it really was a craft in those days where, you know, spray glue and scalpels and bits of paper and pencils and stuff were the tools of the trade, and computers had barely been thought of. So I was always fascinated by that. But of course, I'd done a history degree, not a graphic design degree. So the way I ended up in graphic design was, I have to tell you, just one of the most extraordinary pieces of, from my point of view, good fortune you can imagine. So I'd come back up to date, and I'd walked out of my job in financial services. My girlfriend Anne had taken me for a meal to cheer me up, basically, because it was looking like, what else am I going to do? I suppose I better see if I can find another job in financial services, and I really didn't want to. So she took me out for just a cheap meal, a little local restaurant here, and we were sitting there, and we got talking to the couple at the next table. And it turned out that they had just moved down from London, and the girl, Carolyn, she was working in theatre administration, and Andrew, the fella, he was a graphic designer. And the thing about Andrew was he was a very talented graphic designer, but he absolutely hated having to go out to get business. He hated selling, right? Mm-hmm. But from my point of view, you know, I'd been selling life insurance. So selling to me was, it was not a problem. You know, it's, when you learn to sell, if you're any good at it anyway, you learn not to take it personally. If someone turns around and says, look, I'm not interested, leave me alone. It's just a numbers game. You know, you right. Thank you very much for your time. And you move on and you pick up the phone and call the next person. I was looking at Andrew and thinking, wow, God, this sounds fascinating, because he was describing the fact he'd got hold of one of these new Apple Macintosh computers that was still not particularly well known. So this was 1991 and they were still incredibly expensive. I mean, I don't, you're still quite young, Jonathan, but I, so you would probably have been obviously at about 10 years old at this time, my dear fella. But computers were really only just becoming affordable. And I can remember, you know, the first Apple Macintosh computer that Andrew and I bought, I mean, it cost us thousands of pounds for this thing that basically you'd laugh at now. It had a little 10-inch, I'm not joking, a little 10-inch black and white screen. It wasn't even color.
I remember the old Apple IIc. That's my first start with
right.
computers.
Yeah, the Apple IIc and the Mac SE we had. So those were the first two computers. The Mac SE we bought secondhand, and it still cost us something like, I don't know, £1,500 for this tiny little thing. And we had a 2 SE, and it was that cost us about £3,000 with just a standard, what was it, 14-inch screen. So anyway, we got talking, and he was thinking, oh, wow, someone who can sell. And I was thinking, wow, a way for me to get involved in graphic design and that kind of stuff. Well, 2 weeks later, we set up in partnership. And we were in partnership for 9 years. And we became one of the most successful graphic design agencies in Brighton, our hometown here. And we were doing lots of big jobs for blue chip clients. And we did all Brighton and Hove Council's tourism publications. And we ended up having fancy offices on, you know, in the center of town and that kind of stuff. And it was good for a while. And then, as can happen, Jonathan, like, you know, guys who are in a band together for too long, you realize that our interests are diverging. Mm-hmm. And we just weren't singing from the same song sheet anymore. I think that would be fair to say. And so the end of 1999, 2000, we kind of split. And what had happened in the meantime, of course, had been really the birth of the internet. And I was actually one of the first web designers in the south of England. I started teaching myself HTML code back in, 1995, something like that. For the first couple of years, I was saying to clients, oh, gosh, I can do a website for you. I can do a website for you. And the clients were replying, what's a website? I mean, it's hard to imagine now, but it's true. So I'd spent all this time teaching myself to do this HTML code stuff. And I thought, oh, God, have I made a huge mistake? And then kind of around about 1997, suddenly it changed. And all our clients came knocking at our door saying, right, Henry, you said you could do one of these website things for me. Right, okay, do one now. And I just... it got stupidly, stupidly busy. So we ended up taking on more people to do web design and stuff. And I was training people. Yeah, it's hard to imagine it, but I was training people how to design websites. Now it's so easy for someone to just go and find something online, you know, with templates and what have you to build their own website. But in those days, you know, we were talking about hard coding HTML and JavaScript and CSS and all that kind of boring stuff. So when I split from Andrew, I was kind of primarily still doing web design, And then typically around about 2001, 2002, the web design bubble burst. Because up to that point, as a web designer, you were still quite a rare creature and able to earn a decent living from it. And then suddenly you got, you know, kids doing it in their bedroom and stuff. You know, probably kids like you, Jonathan.
Yeah.
Kids like you ruined my career.
I'm sorry.
But it's true, because suddenly all this software became available and stuff, people could do stuff themselves online. So people, you know, logically start saying, so, well, what do I need a web designer for? Which is a foolish thing for them to say, but they were certainly saying, well, and I'm not prepared to pay you as much as I used to pay you. So I had big premises in the center of town and staff and stuff. So gradually, I downsized. And in the meantime, Annie and I had the attic of our house here converted. So I turned it into a studio and I decided to come and work from home instead. And that's kind of what I've been doing ever since. So that's kind of a CV, Jonathan, to give you a bit of a brief background to show you I'm someone who's always been interested in doing all kinds of different things. So long as my only criteria is so long as they're creative. I love writing, I love designing, I love illustrating, I love, you know, doing music, I like cooking as well, which is why I'm doing all this walking to lose weight, Jonathan. Yeah, I love cooking and entertaining and stuff and languages. So in a sense, when the chance to kind of get battle games off the ground came around sort of late 2005. I jumped at it really partly because it dawned on me, well, this is kind of doing a magazine of my own is an expression of my personality, because I can design it, I can write for it, I can edit other people's stuff, I can do photography for it, I can sometimes do illustrations for it, I can do all the maps for it. And also because I'm a salesman, I can sell advertising and that kind of stuff. So in a sense, it was almost like someone had branded battle games on my forehead at birth, I suppose. And also because of the hobby, you know, playing with toy soldiers is something I've done since I was, I don't know, crikey, 5 or 6 years old, I suppose. The business circumstances of battle games were not quite what I planned, because when I started the venture, I was going to be going into business with someone else. And cutting a very long and complicated story short, they were supposed to be the one providing the money while I provided the expertise. And for very complicated reasons, at the last minute, they had to pull out. So I just had one of those, you know, once in a lifetime questions to answer, which was simply, do I go ahead with this or do I not? And I simply knew that if I didn't go ahead, Jonathan, I would have probably regretted it for the rest of my life.
Well, I'm glad you did go ahead.
You know, well, I am mostly kind of 90%. I mean, it's come close to bankrupting me at times, Jonathan. I've got to tell you that, because there's if anyone thinks that there's big money to be had in producing a War Games magazine, they need to think again. There is not very much money at all. And as you know, there are several other titles out there, you know, competitors as well. And they all have teams of people helping them, you know, because War Games Illustrated has got the whole Battlefront team behind it. Miniature War Games, okay, well, Andrew Hubbock is the editor, but he doesn't do all the writing and layout and that kind of stuff. He puts that out to a graphic design team and what have you. War Games Soldiers and Strategy, that has just reemerged on the market. Wonderful magazine, run by some people I happily consider to be friends of mine now, Jasper Orthroys and Guy Bowers. And of course, Guy is the editor, but he's not like me. He's not doing the typesetting and layout and that kind of stuff. He hands that aspect over to the Caravanserai publishing team, who also do ancient warfare and medieval warfare that you probably know about. So, you know, there's just little me really in the battle games corner saying, oh, hello, please buy one of my magazines. But I'm proud of it now. I think there was a time when I think many people expected me to fail, but now, what is it? I've just produced issue 26. So, you know, that's 5 and a bit years. So I must be doing something right, I'd like to think. So there you are, Jonathan. That's kind of a brief background.
Well, speaking of battle games, and I think battle games is worth a few shows, actually, but, you know, describe it. Like, what separates it from the other magazines that you had mentioned, and why should people buy your magazine? What do you cover? What's your philosophy with it?
I think the simple answer is words. okay.
Can't you elaborate?
Yeah. If you take, War Games Illustrated magazine, mm-hmm. for example, it's 100-something pages. I've lost count now. I really can't remember. It's a big magazine. And my little magazine is 56 pages. But you'll probably find more words in my magazine than in War Games Illustrated. And there's a reason for that. I mean, I like everyone else. I like eye candy, sure. I like picked photographs, nice photographs of pretty War Games figures on lovely terrain and all the rest of it. If you like, War Games Illustrated does what it says on the tin. You know, it's War Games Illustrated, and that's fine. And they've got a tie-in with Osprey Publishing now as well, so they're provided with lots of the artwork that you find in the Men-at-Arms books and that kind of stuff, if you're familiar with the Osprey publications. And that's terrific. And for some people, you know, that's the kind of magazine they like. They just want to keep it light and fluffy and have lots of pretty pictures, and that's absolutely fine. And they do a brilliant job at producing that. I come from a very different sort of approach to the hobby, though. I suppose, the danger is you can end up sounding terribly pompous, but I suppose I'm a bit more cerebral than that. I like something that makes me think. Right. It's probably before your time, Jonathan, but there were a series of magazines produced in the UK that I grew up with. It started with a magazine called Military Modelling, which is still in existence, but Military Modelling in the old days also used to cover wargaming. And of course, back in the late 60s, early 1970s, when wargaming was really kind of just getting going, Military Modelling was the magazine that not only covered those people who like to make, you know, well, you've probably seen them in hobby shops, haven't you, Jonathan, like the Tamiya tank models and things. Incredibly highly detailed, large-scale model tanks and aircraft and that kind of stuff. But also they covered wargaming in the very early days when people were still trying to figure out how on earth you cast a figure as small as 25 millimeters, you know, and often they were using arcane alchemy to do so, probably on their kitchen stoves back home, producing these little blobby things that we used to think were wonderfully detailed at the time. But so there was Military Modelling, and then as the wargaming community grew, there was much more of a demand for a magazine just for them. And so out of the wargaming bits of Military Modelling was born another magazine called Battle for Wargamers, which was, I mean, if any of your listeners remember it, they'll be nodding their heads sagely and going, oh, yeah, that was a fantastic magazine. It really was. There was loads of military history in it. There was loads of kind of really in-depth articles about the hobby of wargaming and how to play war games, that kind of stuff. The whole thing about how do you design a set of war games rules, because you've got to remember, Jonathan, or learn, back in those days, I mean, there was no mass publishing industry for war games rules. I mean, now you're excited because you've bought Black Powder, you know, Rick Priestley's Black Powder and his new ancient rule set, Hail Caesar, has come out. And these are beautifully produced hardback books costing, well, in UK money, £30 a time. What's that like? I don't know what you're paying over in the States, $40 for them?
Like that.
Yeah, 45, you know, maybe nearly $50, depending on the exchange rate. But, you know, there was nothing like that, nothing at all like that. And no DBA, none of these Field of Glory, you know, Ancients rules and all these lavish rule sets. Most people, when they played a war game, they'd written their own rules. And over time, gradually, there were people like the War Games Research Group emerged, who produced little stapled together pamphlets, basically kind of little, just take US letter size a paper and stick half a dozen sheets together that had been typed and then photocopied. That was a set of rules. That was considered, wow, the big time, you know. So... but I remember, you know, because I was around when all this was happening, and there were a lot of really good books about wargaming at the time. There was a not just in the UK, actually. There were some fairly famous at the time wargamers in America. There's a name I'll throw at you, Joe Morshauser. I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but he was kind of famous at the time. But over most of the big wargame names were British. There was Don Featherstone, who, just through reading Battle Games, you would have seen his name. There was Charles Grant. Now, you've been reading Battle Games, so you've seen the tabletop teasers by Charles Stuart Grant. Well, Brigadier Charles Stuart Grant is the son of what we call the Great Charles Grant. Now, the Great Charles Grant, who sadly died quite a few years ago now, but he wrote a book in 1971 called The War Game, which was my Bible. You know, I couldn't afford to buy the book because it was probably something like a couple of pounds in those days, which was way beyond my pocket money, but I used to borrow it over and over again from the local library, because you're a librarian, aren't you, Jonathan?
I do work in a library, yeah.
Yeah, so, well, the library, this was where I discovered all these books. There was a fantastic wargaming section in my local library. So there were all these books by Don Featherstone and Charles Grant and several others, C.F. Wesencraft and G.W. Jeffrey, and, you know, you're probably going, who on earth are all these people? Well, trust me, they were people who, several of them sadly, who've died now, but they were famous as the doyens of the hobby. These were the people who were kind of inventing the hobby of wargaming. Oh, another one, of course, Terry Wise, who, again, you'd have seen his name in Battle Games.
Terry Wise Awards.
Yeah, the Terry Wise Award. Terry Wise wrote a number of books. Introduction to Battle Gaming was one that came out in the early 1970s. And that's where I got the idea for the name of my magazine, Battle Games. You know, so there's all these people. The thing was, because in those days, Jonathan, there was no, if you like, game in a box. There was no Warhammer 40K or Warhammer Fantasy, where you could just walk into this amazingly stocked shop and there's all the stuff on the walls, all produced by the same company at a consistent scale, and you can walk over to a shelf and pick up a box and go to the checkout and say, I want that, please, and you hand over your, oh my God, in the UK now, that's probably about £60, what, close to $100, I would have thought, isn't it now? Mm-hmm. And walk out the shop and you've got everything you need. You've got the figures, you've got the paints, you've got the brushes, you've got the rule books, you've got the book telling you how to make the terrain, you've got the little tools even for snipping the blooming things off the sprues. There was just nothing like that. We were, you know, in those early days, you'd see something in one of the magazines, say you'd see something in Battle for Wargamers, and you'd have no idea how they produced this thing. It might be a house or a tree or a hill, or, you know, some piece of scenery or some beautifully painted figure. Because that's the other thing, my goodness. Even the photography in those days was mostly in black and white. So they had, say, in the full magazine might be, I don't know, 56 pages. Well, the outside covers were probably in color, and maybe the center pages were in color, but all the rest was in black and white. So you would be seeing these photographs of these war games figures or whatever, and the first question is, well, what color are they? That's the thing you have to, so. And the other thing, there was no Osprey books. There were very few, you know, easily available books about military history. So it took real research to find out that, oh, crikey, well, a sergeant of the French Grenadier Guards of Napoleon. Oh, right, so it's a blue uniform and white trousers and a black bearskin hat and, oh, that's a red plume. And, you know, all these things were, it was like uncovering this incredible mystery. And I think that's why, Jonathan, a lot of older wargamers, they get a bit sniffy. they get a bit funny when, you know, they hear youngsters today complaining about, oh, you know, there was no instructions for this in this box of whatever I bought. I'm thinking, God, you know, nowadays you have it so easy, and we can end up sounding like real old duffers, real old men, you know, sitting on the park bench grumbling. And but simply because in the early days of wargaming, it's true, you know, we really did have to go and find out this stuff. So, you know, this, if you like, informed my early involvement with the wargaming hobby and my memories of the war games magazines and books that I loved, because there were so many articles in those days that were just packed full of information about the hobby itself, about gaming. And so why do we have, you know, do we think that veteran troops should be given plus one, you know, when we're playing a war game? Do we think that the march rates of cavalry compared to infantry should be this instead of this? Do we think it's important to just have a game that's more chess-like, or do we think it's important to have a game where you're making lots and lots of tiny, tiny decisions? All this stuff was talked about all the time in the earlier days of the hobby. Whereas now what tends to happen is, like with the Warhammer thing, people like, also people have less time now. They're more busy. So they tend to think, right, actually, I've only got, you know, a couple of hours, maybe a maximum of 4 hours on average to play a game. And I'm really busy. I tend to be tired. So more or less, I want something that's easy to do. I want something that says, right, here's all the facts and figures you need. Do this, roll this number of dice, buy these figures. Here we are. We've got a whole rack of them, and to make your life easy. But that's not kind of the direction I come from. So battle games, in a sense, you know, some people would say, oh, it's a bit old fashioned. And maybe they're right, Jonathan. You know, I have to accept that if you read battle games, the average issue of battle games, you end up having to do a bit of thinking. There are quite a lot of words in there. So in that sense, I recognize that my magazine is not for everyone. But what I hope comes across in battle games, and you've now read enough issues to be able to make a judgment about that, is that the magazine, I hope, conveys a real passion for the hobby, a real passion for getting people to think about what it is they're doing when they're playing a war game, but also has a sense of fun, you know, kind of doesn't take itself too seriously, but it has a kind of questioning attitude to everything.
I think there's a benefit to, like, I read battle games on my iPad. I have a digital subscription, and I access it that way. And I think there's a benefit to that because, as you said, you know, there's terminology that readers might not be completely familiar with. Well, if you're using some sort of e-reader, you can most likely look it up. Or, like, with the iPad, since it's a tablet computer, I just can hop on the web, and I can go research any companies that are mentioned, names or rule sets, and just find out more about them. And additional information, it just makes it really easy. So it does fulfill that, you know, everything combined in a box aspect for me. But at the same time, it forces me to go outside that box and see what else is going on and, you know, why things are in that box.
Sure. Because I've been really interested in your progress, Jonathan. The fact that you've come from kind of a sci-fi fantasy gaming background where most things are based around a particular gaming system.
Yeah.
Compared to then you encounter historicals and you're excited about, oh, this black powder, lovely, lovely, lovely. But then it was brilliant listening to the questions you raised about, well, what size figures should I use? I mean, that's the first thing. You come into historical gaming, and I've talked about this quite a lot with Neil Shuck over on our View from the Veranda podcast. You come into historical gaming, and you're confronted by, first of all, okay, what period am I interested in? And let's say it's the Black Powder period, so let's say roughly 1700 to 1850, roughly. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're interested in that period. Fantastic. Okay, who produces miniatures for this period? Oh, my God, there's hundreds of them. Secondly, having decided on your manufacturer potentially, what scale of figure do you want to use? Do you want 6 mil? Do you want 10 mil? Do you want 12 mil? Do you want 15 mil? Do you want 18 mil? Do you want 20 mil? Do you want 25 mil? Do you want 28 mil? Or even now, do you want 40 mil? Right? Mm-hmm. So there's this, oh my God, I can fully understand why someone wouldn't even get past that stage, Jonathan. It's one of the big problems for historical wargaming. But let's say you've decided, as you have, right, okay, I've decided I like 28mm miniatures, and if I'm not mistaken, in fact, you've decided you really like the Perry miniatures, don't you?
They're fantastic. And
they're gorgeous.
I think people think they're a little pricey, but I don't see them as being as pricey as people seem to think.
Especially, I think, Jonathan, because you've come from the fantasy and sci-fi gaming world where people are used to paying more per miniature.
That's true. I compared them to Games Workshop products, and I did a price per model, and I said, these are like half the price of some GW thing. Yep. Of course it's affordable to me.
Yep. And the irony is, of course, that Perry miniatures are sculpted by two of Games Workshop's own most talented sculptors.
Absolutely. So,
fantastic irony there. But anyway, so you choose Perry miniatures. You've managed to get through those, what's that, two or three hurdles already. Fantastic. So then it's right, okay, how many of them do I need? You know, so, and I remember you saying, so, gosh, you look at the pictures in Black Powder and you can see the average battalion might have 40 or 50 miniatures in it. Oh my goodness me, because that has implications both in terms of the expense involved, but also in terms of the amount of space they take up when you're playing a game. And how much, you know, I don't know how much space you have at home, you know, when you're collecting things.
You
end up thinking, you know, never enough, like most of us, where are you going to put them? And also, how long is it going to take me to paint these before I can then play a game with them? You know, so it does throw up all these questions. And so then let's say you've decided, right, well, I'm going to make most of my units 18 miniatures or 24 miniatures, whatever it turns out to be. Fantastic. You've made that decision. So then it's okay. Right. So what color do I paint them? And where's all the historical, you know, uniform reference material? And now, these days, it has to be said, we are incredibly fortunate that we do have Osprey Publishing, who, you know, it doesn't matter where you are in the world, you want to find out what the uniform of, you know, a Kentucky militiaman is, let's say, you can find out with a fair degree of accuracy. I mean, there are still some periods of history, particularly the Napoleonic period, where you can meet people who are real, what's a polite way I could express it, they're real button counters, let's say. They are the kind of people who will hover over your war games table looking at your lovingly painted troops at a show, let's say, and eventually will say, I think you'll find... And they're the kind of people who, quite frankly, deserve a slap. There's no other way of putting it. But, you know, forget those people because they don't count for anything. And it often makes me want to say, well, show me your collection. And it turns out, actually, they haven't got one. But anyway, certainly, you know, there are lots of things when you first come to historical wargaming where there are decisions to be made at every stage. And, of course, the other thing you have to bear in mind is, well, it's all very well me deciding to do all these things, who am I going to play against? And are they happy to make the same decisions? Because this has happened to me, and I think it's happened to most historical war gamers, and it happened to me not too long ago, where there's a guy who writes for the magazine, who's got an article in this latest issue, actually, Dan Mersey, right?
It's funny you mention him. I'm looking at his article as you're talking.
There you go. So Dan Mersey, he's a lovely guy, very, very deeply knowledgeable about particularly the Dark Age period, you know, Vikings and Saxons and the Arthurian legends, that sort of stuff, and has a deep interest in ancients as well. And it's a couple of years ago now, I got smitten, I would have to say. I suddenly fell in love with Bacchus miniatures, the 6mm, tiny, tiny, tiny miniatures. And at the same time, I was first coming to another set of rules that Rick Priestley wrote, actually, called War Master. And War Master is ideally suited for fighting big
Ancients battles. And the rules are quite stylized. Having played Black Powder, Jonathan, you would find them very familiar, because a lot of the mechanisms in Black Powder are kind of based on what he wrote in War Master originally. So they're a good flowing, good set of rules for big battles. And so I decided visually I wanted big battles, Greeks and Persians, ancient Greeks and Persians, because it's one of the periods I fell in love with when I was a kid, actually. And I decided, right, what I'm going to do is get Dan involved, and we'll do Greeks and Persians in 6mm. So I went out and bought a load of Bacchus miniatures, 6mm Greeks and Persians. And it was only a matter of a couple of months later, we had a conversation where I was saying, right, Dan, so are you going to be buying some Bacchus 6mm stuff, you know, Greeks, Persians, Sassanids, or, you know, Romans, whatever? And he went, do you know what? I've decided I prefer 15mm. And this happens all the time. I mean, you can't get angry with him, because if that's what he prefers, if he prefers 15mm miniatures, well, he does, you know, and it's his money, it's going to be his collection. So, but it's kind of, right, so what am I going to do with all these 6mm figures now? So, you know, stuff like that happens all the time in a way that it just doesn't, you know, because I've played a lot of Warhammer Fantasy in over the years as well. And you know that, well, okay, I like Skaven, for example. Skaven were my favourite army for a long time, and Empire as well, and Bretonians. And so, but you knew that if you went down the shop to get a game with someone, with your, you know, Games Workshop Skaven, you weren't going to get there and suddenly have someone turn up with, I don't know, 15mm goblins. Right? Or 40 millimeter something else, 40mm dark elves. It just wouldn't happen, because everyone in that environment is driven by the game system that is on sale. And so the rules are produced by the company, the figures are produced by the company, the paints are produced by the company, the brushes are produced by the company, the bases to mount everything on are produced by the company, even the scenery is produced by the same company. So you just never kind of get that total random, oh my God, what do we do now, sort of thing. So there we are.
Well, getting into Black Powder, I mean, as you know, because I'm so grateful to you, and I loved your reply to my email basically saying, so what do I do now? But like, opening up the rule book and seeing that, you know, there were no army lists, there were no points, and I like, my world literally shattered, and I said, okay, so how do you play this dang thing, and then what do I do? But, like, choices, so, and, you know, insofar as, like, what scale models, do I do 15mm, do I do 6, or 40, whatever, some of that stuff was kind of, I guess, already made for me, because where I play, there are people who got into this beforehand, and they ended up choosing, you know, 28mm parries, I think in part because these people are heavy into 40k and Warhammer Fantasy, so I think they cut, the 28mm is very familiar to them, and then when I got into it, I said, well, you know, I like the 28mm, I like the detail on it. I love what the Perrys did with the Lord of the Rings line. So I'm going to give, you know, them a try since it would fit in with everything else. And then I was telling others who play Flames of War, and we do like board games and so forth every Wednesday, actually. And so I was telling them about it, and others expressed interest. And, you know, I got the, well, we'll play, but we're not going to buy or paint or assemble anything. But if people have extra stuff, then we'll play. And that's all well and good. But then there was one gentleman who's really into Napoleonics, and he said, well, this sounds like fun. Are you doing Napoleonics? And I hate to tell him, but I said, well, no, actually, we're doing Rev War. And he's like, okay, well, I'll do Rev War too, but I'm not buying anything until you've actually painted some of your models. Because I hate to say it, I'm one of those guys who falls in love with something and convinces everyone else that you need to fall in love with this too. And then I decide, well, I'm done with that. I found something else I want to fall in love with.
Yeah.
So I kind of, I move forward a lot with that. And so he's learned from that and said, well, you know, once you actually have stuff and you have it painted, I'll start ordering my stuff. So that was actually a good impetus for me to kind of go ahead and say, okay, I got my parries. I need to, you know, paint a model and get going and get them out. And as soon as I got my first group done, I eagerly sent him an email with pictures and said, "Hey, Adrian, look what I got. Go order your stuff now." I was like, it's for real.
Yeah. And also, there was that other chap who sent you a huge box of slightly smaller figures, hasn't he? The plastic 1/72nd scale stuff.
Yep, his name is Court. He's he's lived in the area for a while, the area where I play. But he always thought no one played historicals, which is what he's really into. So he would come, like, on, say, Fridays or whatever, days that we weren't there. And he would see people playing Magic, The Gathering, and playing, you know, 40K and War Machine. And then think, okay, well, this is what they're playing, but it's not for me. And I'll come back another day and see what's going on. So he did that for years, a few years. And then he started seeing, actually, this podcast being mentioned online and talking about Battleground Games and Hobbies, which is where we play. And so he's like, wait, I go there, and how come I don't see you? So he actually met me in person and gave me, I think they turn out to be Accurate, I think is the manufacturer of them, I believe.
All right.
Miniatures, and they're amazing. I have no intention of, you know, painting them, but he said, you know, here, take these and use this as a chance for the group to get some experience with black powder. So I'm working on, well, I'm doing it the cheap way, I guess you could say. I took, you know, a old cereal box, cut it up, and made bases out of that, used some white glue.
Fantastic!
That way I can just pop them off, and, you know, if there's another rule system I end up liking, and they'd be based different, I can do that. But I am going to put some flock on the bases, because otherwise they're, you know, hunks of plastic on pieces of brown cardboard.
Well, hearing you talk about cereal boxes is fantastic, because when I started out, that's precisely what I did. I mean, those sorts of plastic figures you've got, I mean, they're often you find that the original sculpts were done by some other company, and then they're produced under license by various companies. Mm-hmm. Because there was, and there still is now, Airfix, Revel, Eshi, Italeri, and in recent years the advent of a Russian company called Zvezda, who make fantastic models. All my, I'm doing a whole load of we'll come back to that. Another load of Greeks and Persians using Zvezda plastic 1/72nd scale miniatures, because they are just beautiful. They are exquisitely sculpted. But yeah, in the old days, cereal packets, my goodness me, we used to get through boxes and boxes of cornflakes and shredded wheat and good knows what at home. I swear, more or less, so I could have the cardboard for making bases for the miniatures. And of course, I also used to make my own buildings out of cereal packets. And the only thing was that the cereal packet cardboard is a bit too thin. So what happens is, if you can make it looking nice, and it's all got the white side out and all the rest of it, it looks lovely, and then you paint it, and of course it warps. So I had some really wonky looking buildings in the early days. But yeah, mounting them on the cardboard for the bases is, yeah, that's, you're getting really traditional there, Jonathan. Well, my goodness me,
I wish I could say it came easy, but unfortunately, as listeners know, I have a couple of rabbits. And rabbits love to tear apart all things cardboard. So I have to, like, sneak pieces of cardboard away when my wife's not here. Her instinct is, no, those are, like, we have tons and tons of, like, paper towel rolls just for our bunnies to play with and tear apart. And so boxes, like tissue boxes and, you know, cereal boxes and stuff, that all lives for the bunnies. It's their toys. And, you know, heaven forfend I take any. But of course, now the cat's out of the bag. And when she's not around, I hide them in my car.
Fantastic. You see, you're a true wargamer now, Jonathan. Well, it's true.
Reading Battle Games, I really feel an affinity for the Sutherlands in particular.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Tales of a Wargaming Widow. And, like, I read them and I love how she just refers to her husband as, you know, the wargamer. And what's he doing now with my CDs in China and this and that? And I think, oh, wow. I know. Should read this or shouldn't read this?
I know. And I think one of the best ones, actually, I enjoy, when the very first one she sent me, which is, what she got, the article was called Bags of Potential.
Yes.
And It was all where she was describing how she found her shed full of odd-shaped pieces of polystyrene and bits of old carpet and corduroy and God knows what. And, you know, I had so many emails about that, people saying, do you know what? I was nodding in agreement and laughing as I read that, because I think most we're magpies for the strangest things. You know, we'll buy, you know, we'll look in a skip, you know, I think you call it a dumpster, don't you, over in the States, yeah. Where, oh, what's someone thrown away here? Oh, that's an interesting piece of polystyrene or a stick or a cardboard tube or, you know, anything really. Bits of old sponge. Oh, I could make some hedges or trees out of that piece of old sponge. Or, you know, DIY stores, do-it-yourself stores are my idea of heaven. Because they have all these glues and putties and bits of wood and all the tools as well. You convince yourself, oh, I must get one of those. I'll find a use for that. We're a strange breed. And I've been experimenting with all sorts of different super glues in recent years. You know, this is also why Mike Siggins' column has been brilliant.
He's fantastic.
Because he is self-confessed, I mean, that he is just a magpie. And he'll go to all sorts of different places, you know, shops and different shows and model railway shows and stuff, and find, oh, goodness me, you know, they've got this particular type of flock or glue or whatever. Why has no one been selling this in the war games community? You know, it's extraordinary. Brushes, you know, the different types of brushes. When I was first painting figures, you know, I used to paint, and again, I don't know if they've even still been on sale in your living memory, but enamel paints, oil-based yep. enamel paints, used to be produced almost exclusively by a company called Humbrol. Yep. And so in the old days, of course, when you painted, you just had a couple of brushes and your Humbrol colours, and you dipped into the tin, and you know, there was flesh for the faces, and there was red for the jacket, and there was blue for the collar, and white for the trousers, and all this kind of shading and highlighting stuff is all, you know, something that's come along more recently. But nowadays as well, whereas in my early days, I think I'd have one big brush and one small brush, basically. There are lots of painters now who recommend that you buy whole sets of, you know, 20 different sizes of brush. And for this job, you use this brush, and for that job, you use that brush. And basically, it's these people have invented this, I'm convinced, just a way of convincing us to go and spend more money. It's just out. And the irony is as well that particularly with acrylic paints, because I think 99% of us now have converted over the last 10, 15 years to using acrylic water-based paints rather than slightly toxic and potentially dangerous oil-based ones. When I think of all the years I spent licking my brush after having dipped the brush in Terps, it's surprised I'm not dead yet, actually. But acrylic paint actually is much harder on brushes than oil-based paints. I don't know if you've had this problem, Jonathan, where after a while, when you've been painting for a while, the tip of your brush, it loses the point and it gets kind of a little hook on the end.
Absolutely.
Have you experienced that? And I hate that. It's a nightmare because it never, ever used to happen with oil-based paints. It's only a result of acrylic paints. And I'm not enough of a scientist to understand remotely why it happens, but it does. And it's really infuriating because you have a brush that's, I've got this just as I like it. This brush is painting beautifully. And then suddenly it gets this stupid little hook on the end and you need to basically throw it away. There you go.
That's when you need to take a trip to the craft store. I find myself going to AC Moore, which is a local craft company, and getting my brushes there and saying, oh, well, that's one I haven't seen before. Let me get you. And, oh, and here's one over here. And, well, this could do the same job. And next thing I know, I spent like $40 on brushes. And
I know. I've come up with one solution, which is there's well, we have a company here in the UK called Viking Direct. They're a big business stationers, right? So you can order your business station, your paper, your pens, your this, your that from it. And it's a lot cheaper than in the high street. And one of the things I discovered they do is they do really cheap brushes. And I mean, they're like a fraction of the cost of a brush if you go into an art store. Now, they tend to be kind of a nylon hair that, you know, we're not talking about sable here by any means. But I tell you, 90%+ of the work that you do when you're painting war games figures, they're absolutely fine for. And certainly when you're painting war game scenery, they're cheap as chips, as we would say here in the UK. They're really, really cheap. And as I say, then it means you can save your best brushes for when you're doing, you know, the detail or the highlights, you know, the faces on the figures, that kind of stuff. And so it means that your really good brushes will last a lot longer. And these other brushes, well, if they do wear out or got to get a kinky, you know, tip to them, you can just chuck them in the bin and you know that it's only a matter of pence rather than hang on a minute, I spent, you know, £3 on this brush, £5 maybe, and it's already worn out. Mm-hmm. So that's a lesson I've learned.
I think you raised an interesting point with licking the tip of your brush and wondering how you're still alive. Because my friends and I have this kind of joke going on. There's some products here, some of the plastic glue, some of the products by Testers Company. They do like a Del Coat. But a lot of these products say, I think Zip Kicker has it on it too. It's a product that kind of makes you know, super glue harden quicker.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they all say on them, this will cause cancer in the state of California. So we all joke that, you know, you can only die from these things if you live in California, but it's okay to the rest of the world because it has no effect anywhere else. But I mean, in all seriousness, California must be onto something, and there should be some sort of study or something about the health of war gamers and what does this do to us?
I think there's a lot of things that are unhealthy about wargaming. I think that sniffing too much super glue or something is the least of our problems. I think in general, wargamers just need to get out more and get more healthy. And I think that the extra, you know, few months that using super glue might knock off your life is neither here nor there, really. But hey.
So you're actually, you do quite a bit of walking to help with your health and to get you out and about. I see you posting online about, you know, walking a gazillion kilometers here and there and all the places you see. It's fascinating.
Well, this has come about because of Combat Stress, you know, the charity that you mentioned at the top of the show. When I was young, Jonathan, I was very, 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 very fit. I was what you might call army fit, because I was actually going to join the British Army. And so I had to be fit. I had plans to be an officer in Her Majesty's Royal Horse Artillery, but that's another story. But in those early days, I did a lot of sport. I played a lot of rugby. I did a lot of athletics. I did, you know, weight training, circuit training. I was just a very fit young man. And then what happens is, like with a lot of people, you leave university, you go out and you get a job, and it's a sedentary job. And then year by year, pound by pound, suddenly you look at your waistline and you think, how did that happen?
Yep.
And I had a health scare a couple of years ago, which was mentioned in the editorial of one of my magazines and on one of the early posts on my blog, actually. I got a thing called cellulitis in my left leg. And I don't know if you know what cellulitis is, but it's basically a bacterial infection of the bloodstream. And what happened was my left leg swelled up to twice its normal size. And I can tell you, it's the most painful thing I've experienced in my life. And this just came out of nowhere. It wasn't actually, you know, it's not caused by my lifestyle. It can happen to anyone, but it suddenly made me realize how physically vulnerable I was, as, you know, someone who spent most of my life doing all kinds of mad physical things, including, you know, medieval tournament fighting and fencing, and I did kendo and lots of other stuff, martial arts. And suddenly here I was suffering from this bizarre disease I'd never heard of, you know, this extraordinary infection, and being told that, oh, actually, yes, you were lucky we caught it when it did, because it can lead to amputation or death, and I'm quoting there, that came as quite a shock. And also the fact that because I'd become such a big guy, you know, in excess of, let's have a think, my top weight, I've weighed in excess of 290 pounds, Jonathan.
Oh, wow.
Right, that's big, right? And I'm not kind of a blobby guy. I've not kind of got sort of wobbly fat. It's just, you know, I'm one of these guys who's reached middle age, and I find that there's more hanging out the front of my trousers over the top of the belt than underneath it, you know. It meant that when I had this cellulitis thing, where it was agony to walk, basically, and obviously being too heavy meant that it was even more agony. It made it even more difficult. So I had a first conversation with my doctor at the time, and she said, oh, you know what, if you really ought to consider losing some weight for your own, you know, comfort and safety. And then at some point last year, I had a blood test with my doctor, and she said, oh, my blood sugar levels were borderline, you know, verging on diabetes. And that's something I really was a wake-up call. I thought, God, you know, this is definitely, I do not want to become diabetic. This is just something I do not want that to happen. So it also, as you know, with the magazine for two or three years now, I've been promoting the Combat Stress Charity for members of the British Armed Services who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And I've been, you know, collecting money through the magazine, organising stuff to raise funds for this charity through the magazine. But I thought, well, why not kind of kill two birds with one stone and come up with something that would be, if you like, a big gesture to really give a boost to the fundraising, and at the same time do me some good. Because I'm one of those people, Jonathan, that I will move heaven and earth to help other people, but I'm absolutely useless at helping myself. It's just, you know, it's the nature of the things. I suppose I'm a good team player, and I, like I say, I will do anything, lay down my life for other people, but when it comes to doing something that's good for me, I'm absolutely useless. So I came up with the idea of, well, why don't I do a sponsored walk to raise money? And then it's just a matter of, you know, how big a sponsored walk, and where will I go, and when will I do it? These questions start to emerge. And I don't quite know how exactly it came about, but I heard myself saying to someone, oh, yes, I'll do 250 miles in a week.
Ooh.
Okay, that's a really long way.
Yeah, that is.
That's like 30-something miles per day for 7 days on the trot. Well, it was only afterwards I thought, oh, my God, what have I said? Well, okay, I'll start getting into training, because it was just a number. But it was also inspired by two things in particular. First of all, I don't know if you've heard of the British comedian Eddie Izzard.
Yep.
Right, because obviously he's getting quite well known in the States now as well. He's been in several movies, as well as doing his stand-up comedy and stuff. Brilliant comedian. But also, last year, he did this extraordinary thing where he ran 43 marathons in 43 days.
Oh, wow.
With no training. Just sheer willpower, right? And a medical team following him. That has to be added, right? So he is a celebrity. So he decided he was going to do this thing, which is fantastic, to raise money for charity and stuff. And obviously, being a rich and famous celebrity, first of all, he can afford to take, you know, a month and a half off to do it. Secondly, he had a TV crew with him, and he had a physiotherapist and a doctor and various advisors and all that kind of stuff. So, but, you know, not to take it away from him, he did this incredible thing purely because of his utter determination to do it. A driven man in the real sense of the word. So that was the first thing that made me think, God, you know, it just shows you. There was a time in my early, you know, in my youth, when I would have thought, God, you know, I'll do that. You know, I wouldn't have thought twice. I was fit enough to do it. Then there was last November, there was to raise money, I think it was to raise money for the Help for Heroes charity that we also have here that helps wounded soldiers. Four teams, one from the Royal Navy, one from the Army, one from the Royal Air Force, one from the Royal Marines. Four teams of, I think it was five guys per team, did march 250 miles in 1 week. They set off from different points in the country and they all met up in the centre of London at the Cenotaph War Memorial, having marched 250 miles per team in a week. So that again made me think, well, obviously it's possible. Now, anyone with half a brain, Jonathan, and I'm sure you've got more than half a brain, is thinking, yeah, but hang on a minute, Henry. Those guys are trained soldiers, sailors, airmen and Marines. These guys are paid to be fit to defend their country. Whereas, Henry, you're a fat magazine editor. But there you go. You know, it's like you have to aim for the stars in the hope that you might land on top of a cloud. That's kind of my philosophy in life. So when someone asked me, they said, oh, yeah, I'll do 250 miles in a week. Well, I've been taking lots of advice since then from people who've been sort of nodding their heads sagely and tut-tutting, you know. And it may be that, and I don't want to use the word only here to sound flippant, but I may only do 125 miles in a week, right? Now, to anyone else, they're still thinking, hang on a minute, Henry, that's, you know, 20-odd miles a day still. But it's a more sensible and achievable target, probably, for me. But I'll see how it goes. My plan is that sometime, probably roughly this time of year next year, kind of May, June time next year, I'm going to do this mega walk, and it will certainly involve doing at least, as far as I'm concerned, 25 miles a day. I've definitely decided that now. It's going to be at least 25 miles or just short of a marathon distance each day for 7 days. So effectively, that's going to be, how's my math coming along? 175 miles, something like that, in 1 week. And I think that that's a spectacular enough distance for people to be able to say, hey, he was once a 290-pound fat magazine editor. He's, let's say, I'd like to think by then I've got down to maybe 260 pounds at least, or less, magazine editor. And so this is why I'm doing these long walks, Jonathan. So they're my training, just getting used to walking non-stop for, I mean, at the moment, my best is just under 15 kilometers. So however many miles is that? I don't know. Someone's going to do I'll get my calculator. What do you know what that is in miles, Jonathan? So 15 times 5 divided by 8, that is 9.37 miles.
That's pretty good.
That's not bad, non-stop. But obviously, if I'm going to be doing this thing, I need to be building that up. So, and the other thing is, I must point out, by the end of a 15-kilometer walk, I am absolutely dead on my feet. And what I'm having to think seriously about is, God, if I'm going to do this big walk, it will mean doing that, resting for half an hour, and then doing it again, and then resting for half an hour, and then doing it again. And then resting for half an hour and doing a bit more, in fact. I need to break it down more cleverly. But, you know, we're talking about roughly 50 kilometers a day. And that will mean I will be walking for 10 to 12 hours a day. For every day for a week. And the fact of the matter is, I know that's going to really hurt. So there's an old saying used in the military, isn't it? Train hard, fight easy. So, you know, I'm gradually making the training harder. I'm starting to wear a rucksack with, you know, several kilos of stuff in it. And I need to build that up because realistically, again, if I'm going to be doing these walks, I very much doubt I'm going to have the luxury of Eddie Izzard's support team coming with me. So I'm going to have to carry, you know, my food, my water, change of clothes and everything in a rucksack on my back that probably is going to weigh, I don't know, 15 or 20 kilos, something like that. So I have a serious need to get seriously fit, Jonathan. There you are. That's what the walks are all about.
Well, I think it's admirable you're doing this, and it's clear how passionate you are about helping combat stress, but Why did you choose them? How did you choose to get involved with them?
Two reasons. First of all, Brigadier Charles Grant, who writes has been writing for Battle Games up until recently, he is one of the life presidents of the Combat Stress Charity. So it was actually through him that I first learned of its existence at all. Post-traumatic stress disorder has always been, if you like, the Cinderella side of what can happen to someone in the armed services. But it's very obvious. You know, if a guy comes back from Iraq or Afghanistan and they've, you know, poor people, they've had their leg blown off or their arm shot or something of that kind, it's a very visible injury that people immediately sympathize with them, and quite rightly. No, I'm not sort of making out that somehow, oh, it's maybe physical, but it's not real. It's very, very real and traumatic for the individual concerned and their family and their loved ones and so on and so forth. But combat stress, post-traumatic stress disorder, is something that is much more insidious. First of all, because, of course, people who join the military tend to join the military or get selected for the military because they are tough, resilient, self-reliant individuals who can put up with a great deal of hardship and danger that the average citizen would quite simply run away from, right? And so this notion, this kind of macho notion of them being able to cope with everything is perpetuated. But the fact of the matter is, of course, that many, many people who've been in the armed services have seen terrible, terrible things and have experienced terrible, terrible things that may not even be directly related to action, to combat. You know, it's easier to grasp, Jonathan, if you went like on YouTube these days and in various TV documentaries, there are guys now who go out on the front line, they've got cams on their helmet, you know, and they're recording their own combat experience on the front line, and they come back and they upload it to YouTube, or, you know, there's a amazing BBC documentary that was shown just last week about some guys in the Royal Anglian Regiment where exactly this, they'd had the cameras on their helmets and they'd been filming what had been going on, and one of their guys got shot. And obviously that's an easy to understand traumatic experience, both for the guys who got shot and also for the guys who witnessed them getting shot and one of them died and all the rest of it. However, there have been other conflicts that are more difficult to grasp, such as what happened in the conflicts in Bosnia and Kosovo in the 1990s, where our guys and, you know, American guys as well were posted to these countries as peacekeeping troops. And they were severely limited what they could actually do. And their hands were tied. You know, they knew that they were staring straight at the bad guys, but they weren't allowed to shoot them, you know, because of the restraints put on them by the United Nations mandates and that kind of stuff. And particularly there was these awful instances, places like Srebrenica, where they discovered the mass graves that you may remember in the news at the time. And so the guys who discovered these things were also soldiers, but they witnessed this, you know, gruesome stuff, but they weren't able to do anything about it. Now, that kind of experience can have as much of a deeply scarring effect on someone as if they see their best friend killed next to them in the front line. And also these days, because you've got, you know, those parts of the armed services that previously would be considered, used to be muttered, they're not proper soldiers because they're only driving trucks or they're delivering the mail or whatever it is. But in somewhere like Afghanistan or Iraq, these people are also in the front line because of IEDs, you know, the improvised explosive devices. So people who, in, you know, 20 years ago might think, oh, I'll join, I don't know, the logistics corps or the catering corps. So it's kind of soldiering, but you're not often in danger. Well, nowadays, they're in danger every day as well. And more than that, it's not just the regular army that's being used because of the sheer number of troops required, particularly here in the UK, Jonathan, where we've had a series of kind of extensive defence cuts, reducing the number of troops in the regular army. They're becoming more and more reliant on what we here call the territorial army, which in the States you'd probably call the National Guard. So people who are, most of the time, they are actually civilians, but for like a month a year they go on training or whatever. Well, suddenly lots more of these people are being called up and serving long periods in the front line alongside the regular army. And what this means, Jonathan, is that an awful lot of these people are coming back with traumatic experiences that, and like, you know, everyone in life, some people cope with things better than others. And so some people can see the most terrible things, but they manage to find a way of coping with that and putting it out of their mind, and they can get on with their lives. But other people, maybe years later, and the statistics I'm given by the Combat Stress Charity is that it can be as many as 7 to 10 years later, they first start showing the symptoms of combat stress, of post-traumatic stress disorder. And these symptoms often take the form of sudden mood swings, trying to medicate themselves using alcohol or drugs, or them suddenly becoming violent, or suddenly becoming depressed and tearful, you know, at odd times. So I think, you know, I'm mentioning this because it may be that your listeners are going, hang on, I know someone like that who's served, you know, in your army, or navy, or air force, whatever, who's exhibiting these kind of symptoms. Well, the fact is, if that's the case, they need to get help. And whilst it would be in the UK, it would be lovely to think that all this help could be provided by the state, because let's face it, these people have suffered these psychological injuries because they have been serving their country. The fact of the matter is that this help is not provided by the government. And particularly because many of these people, as I say, they don't develop even the symptoms until years after they've left the armed services. You know, so they may have been in Afghanistan, because Afghanistan's been going on, well, 10 years now. They may have been in Afghanistan in the early years of the conflict, may have served 5 years in the army. They've been out of the army 5 years now, and it's only now they're starting to show the symptoms. So they need help, and it's not necessarily provided by the state, and this is where combat stress steps in. So that's kind of that part of the story, Jonathan. The other simple thing is that having learned a great more about combat stress, what it does, and the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, I realized that my own father, he died when I was only 10 years old, but I have enough memory of my father to realize that he was probably suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder from his experiences in World War II. Because I remember as a little boy him suddenly getting upset and tearful and angry and stuff for it seemed like no reason. But he was probably suffering the nightmares of what he had experienced in World War II. So that, of course, gave me a very personal reason, if you like, to feel like this is a charity that I very much wanted to support.
Now, if listeners want to, you know, support the charity as well, how would they do that?
Well, it's very simple. Very kindly, we've had American citizens contributing to my combat stress appeal, which is wonderful. And this is made possible largely because of the internet nowadays. And there's a website that I've set up for the Battle Games Combat Stress Appeal using an organization called Just Giving. And the address of the website, Jonathan, they can go to www.justgiving.com/battlegames, and obviously battle games is all one word, lowercase. So that's www.justgiving.com/battlegames, and they'll see the page there with links to the Combat Stress Charity and that kind of stuff, and they can give as much or as little as they can afford online. I mean, it's I've been amazed. It really has ranged from people who said, you know, I can spare a couple of pounds, up to, you know, we've had some astonishing donations of many hundreds of pounds, which is amazing. But so far, I set an initial target of £10,000, Jonathan, which is, what's that, like $15,000? Mm-hmm. And we've raised basically, it's about £8,500 now. I need to also say that if you're a UK resident, any donation that you make, the charity can also reclaim tax on that donation. So say you give £1, in fact, the charity is able to get back an extra, I'm not sure what the amount is, I think it might be 25 pence, something like that, on top of your donation, which is absolutely fantastic. So it helps the total to build up. But as I say, we've had donations from all around the world, including a number of, you know, very generous American citizens, which is I'm very, very grateful for. So that's tremendous. So, you know, £8,500 so far. What I'm hoping is, Jonathan, when I do the walk, when the long march actually happens next year, I'm hoping to be able to kind of, whatever we've raised so far, and probably by then, I'm hoping it'll be about £10,000, I'm hoping to be able to double the total, so that in the end it will be something like £20,000.
That's fantastic.
Well, it's something. You know, the thing is, Jonathan, that really when you look at the scale of the problem, it's a tiny amount, really. I mean, £20,000 will pay roughly, I don't know, the salary for a single nurse carer for a year. One of the nurse carers who helps at some of the residential centres that the Combat Stress Charity has. You know, it won't pay the salary of a consultant. You know, a consultant earns probably two or three times that amount. To my mind, it's on the one hand, yes, I suppose it looks like a big amount, but I'm very conscious that it's a huge problem, and this is just a drop in the ocean. It's just kind of the bit that I can do, really, Jonathan. There you are. If I was a rich man, I'd, you know, write them a huge check tomorrow. But unfortunately, I'm not a rich man.
I think it's pretty exceptional for an individual such as yourself to do all of this to help out a charity. I know that when Prince William was getting married, it was announced that they didn't really want presents per se. That if you felt the need to make a gift, that they wanted you to donate to one of the charities that they had picked. And one of the ones that I'm told he's a patron of is Combat Stress. So I'm sure that helped to raise, I'm hoping, a vast amount of funds to put a bigger dent into this.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not being disingenuous here. I mean, I'm proud of, you know, the fact that my magazine has managed to. I think more than anything, even more than the money, Jonathan, I think I'm proud that because I've got the magazine, I can tell people about the problem. You know, I'm not, because, you know, war gamers, I've got no right to expect them to suddenly donate to this cause more than any other cause. I mean, obviously there are, you know, there must be a million charities in the world. Each of those charities is desperate for money and does wonderful things for people in difficult situations. And, you know, this is just my little bit, if you like. I'm just trying to wave the flag for this particular charity because, partly because I think it's addressing a cause that, as I say, is insidious. It's potentially very dangerous. There are so many troops now who have seen combat and seen terrible things in the conflicts, you know, not just Afghanistan. I mean, most people think, oh, it's about Afghanistan, but it's not. Combat Stress, if you're interested, was actually set up after the First World War to help people who were suffering from shell shock, as they called it in those days, before they recognized it as, you know, combat stress or post-traumatic stress disorder. So it's been around for a long, long time. And, you know, all the guys who fought in World War II and Korea and Vietnam and the Falklands War and, you know, the First Iraq War, the Second Iraq War, the Balkans, and now Afghanistan. There's a huge number of people who in a few years' time could suddenly develop these kind of symptoms, and they're living amongst us, Jonathan. That's the thing. You know, it's the guy at the checkout at the supermarket. It's the guy sitting in the cinema next to you. It's the, you know, the guy who services your car. These are all potentially people who might be, you know, have this problem either now or in the future. So there you are. That's my combat stress thing.
Well, I think it's important for us as gamers to be aware of this, because we often spend our time moving around the little toy soldiers and little tanks or whatever, and, you know, rolling a dice, and, oh, that means that unit is gone, and you remove it from the table. But you have to think about what's the real impact of this. And you might be replicating a battle that was fought 100 years ago, but this is no less real because of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, maybe that's a discussion topic for another time, Jonathan, because that whole thing of what is the morality of wargaming? That's a huge subject. One of the things that's interesting, actually, is the number of guys I've met who are serving or ex-soldiers who play wargames, and they don't worry about that at all. You know, it's us bleeding heart liberals, you know, us civilians who think, oh God, am I doing the right thing by portraying, you know, the death of potentially of these people in a game? And the fact of the matter is that the guys who do it for real, they are quite capable of separating. Now, hang on, guys, this is just a game. Trust me, it is nothing like the real thing. So just get on with playing the game. I think Neil and I had a chat about this actually on View from the Veranda, one of the early ones, and we got some feedback about it from some guys, and it's very interesting because obviously you do get widely divergent opinions about this, ranging from, oh my God, how, you know, the typical lefty protesters is, how can you dare play war games which are kind of glorifying war and death and all that kind of stuff, up to the person at the other end who says, oh, for God's sake, you know, it's just a form of chess, really, get over it. Most of us are somewhere in between. And I don't know about you, Jonathan, but there are still certain conflicts I feel uncomfortable gaming, and certain armies I wouldn't collect. Yeah. I mean, for example, I would not collect SS stuff, World War II SS stuff, for one. I just... it's not something I feel entirely comfortable with. But I fully accept other people don't have the same problem, and that's fine. That's all right. There are other things, you know, I can't get a great deal of joy out of playing post-1945 conflicts. You know, I know, for example, Neil Shuck, there's an interesting point, Neil Shuck of Meeples and Miniatures, he's really keen on Vietnam. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't catch me playing a Vietnam War game, I'm afraid. It leaves me utterly cold. Now, maybe that's just because I've watched too many Hollywood movies about Vietnam, but I can't say there's anything about the Vietnam War that I look at and think, gosh, that's fun. No way. You know, to a certain extent, I have a similar issue with, you know, gaming modern conflicts, Iraq or Afghanistan. I can see, if you like, the educational benefits of doing so. I can certainly see how, you know, certainly if I was a serving soldier, doing some wargaming, some scenarios set in Afghanistan or whatever, would be a really useful way of understanding what I was getting into. But would I do it for fun? No, I wouldn't. I can't see anything that I would want to game about, for example, a guy with a bomb belt strapped to his body running into my platoon and blowing himself up. You know, that to me, that's not for gaming, but that's just me.
So I take it you wouldn't be a fan, and not that you're a fantasy player, but you wouldn't be a fan of, like, Night Goblin Fanatics, for example.
Now, there is a difference. Because actually, I think the goblins are one of the most brilliant armies of the Warhammer world. I think they're funny. I think the Night Goblin Fanatics with their spinning doom balls or whatever they're called, and their doom divers and their squig hoppers and what have you, I think the goblins are absolutely fantastic. But that's because they're completely imaginary, Jonathan. Yeah. And I can make the easy separation between, you know, yes, I'm sure if there really was a race of goblins, You know, and they were amongst us in the high streets of London and New York and Boston, what have you. And suddenly they started, you know, doing this kind of thing. I'm sure I would be more troubled by it. But the fact is that Warhammer, the word fantasy is the important word in that construct.
It helps a lot with everything.
Yeah. Yeah. So, John, let me ask you a question.
Go for it.
Because you've been very kindly, you know, letting me. I can see what you've been very cleverly doing, which is what Neil Shuck does. He presses my hot buttons and then shuts up and lets me get on with it. And you've been doing exactly the same thing. So I do hope your listeners aren't thinking, where's Jonathan gone? Has he gone off to make a coffee or something?
Well, I went out to have a little bit of dinner and, you know, a little yard work and then came back.
But, because I can see that we're kind of approaching the end of our time anyway here. It's kind of – it's 8:15 UK time, and I've got to get ready in a while to go out this evening. But, yeah, let me ask you something. So to discover a bit more about your gaming background. So you – have you done primarily kind of the Warhammer world, 40K and fantasy, or what other gaming systems have you tried out?
Well, I guess it kind of all started with board gaming, really. When I was younger, I got really interested in Access and Allies. I think I was in maybe fourth or fifth grade. There's this private elementary middle school kind of combination here in Massachusetts. And they do a special program on Saturdays for what they call talented and gifted children.
Right.
For some reason, they accepted me. I don't know what they were thinking. But they allowed me into their program. And one of the classes was about creating your own games, making rules and the strategy of it, and this and that, but I mean, obviously, tailored for children in fourth and fifth grade. So I got to play a lot of the great Milton Bradley kind of games, Broadsides and Battle Swords, you know, Access and Allies, A Fortress America, and then there's one I can't remember the name of, but it's like ancient Rome kind of game, and like all this sort of stuff. And then we had to make our own game. So I decided, you know, I was interested in the Crusades at that time, so I decided I was going to, you know, translate the Crusades into like a Risk-style Axis and Allies kind of game. And, you know, do the whole thing with that and this and that. But as a result of that, I got really interested in just board games and historical board games kind of in general. I've always had a love of history, and my degree from college is actually in politics and history. And so, like you, I had the whole kind of, well, I got this degree, now what do I do with it? But that kind of allowed me to move forward, and after graduating high school, I realized I wanted to play with miniatures. A friend of mine had, one day actually in the school library, he was on break or something after school or whatever, and he was looking up Warhammer Fantasy, and I was like, what the heck is that? And that looks interesting. And so after, actually with graduation money from high school, I purchased my first Games Workshop stuff. I got some Space Marines. And was playing with.
So you would have been about, what, 17 or 18 years old at this time?
Yeah, I was about 18 or so.
Yeah.
So that was back in 2000.
Right.
Many moons ago.
Yeah.
But I got my start with, you know, Warhammer 40K and playing with that and Space Marines. And I still have that stuff, actually. A lot of that stuff. A lot of it's in boxes unopened and waiting to be assembled, which is unfortunate.
Yeah.
But a lot of that, and then I got into Warhammer Fantasy because, I don't know, there's something lacking about 40K for me. And I felt that Fantasy was, I don't know, a better game. I liked the ability to have a little more control and see how the strategy and tactics played out and the different armies. And the time period, I guess, if you can even use that phrase with Warhammer Fantasy, kind of appealed to me more. The, you know, close combat situation where you're not able to shoot at something halfway across the table. You might not be able to shoot at all, depending on your army. And then that just kind of, it progressed along. Did that for a long time.
So what were your favorite Warhammer armies then, Jonathan?
Oh, geez. For 40K or for Fantasy?
For Fantasy.
For Fantasy, I have something like 3,000 to 5,000 points of Chaos. Basically, the Chaos Knights, you know, Chaos Warriors, that sort of stuff. I have a Forge World Chaos Mammoth, which is long been a work in progress. But I really fell in love with them. I love the Vampire Counts and the Tomb Kings, the mythology behind all of that's very interesting.
Yeah, because, of course, the Tomb Kings are interesting because, of course, it's a steal from ancient Egypt, effectively, isn't it? It's quite interesting. It reminds me very much of that movie, The Mummy.
Yep, absolutely.
That kind of thing.
Well, I read somewhere, and probably in an old White Dwarf or something, maybe, you know, an editorial from Paul Sawyer back in the day, that part of the inspiration for the Tomb Kings was watching, like, The Mummy and all that kind of stuff, the originals and the remakes. Kind of like how, and I'm sure they would hate to admit it, but, like, Terminator's an inspiration for the Necrons and 40K and so forth. But those were my favorites, but I always kind of had a love for the Night Goblins, actually, for Orcs and Goblins, but there was no way I was going to assemble and paint a Horde army, so I give you a lot of props for your Skaven. That's a feat.
Yeah. I just thought the thing with the Skaven, a bit like the Goblin, I just thought they were wonderfully funny. And in fact, my long-term wargaming chum and I, Guy Hancock, and I, we did quite a lot of sort of Warhammer Fantasy mini campaigning, and with he was really into the Dark Elves at the time, and I had the Skaven, and it was the thing with the Skaven is, as you probably know, that they are capable once in a blue moon of doing something spectacularly good, but most of the time it blows up in their faces, and you know, I had many games where my sense of humor kind of reached its limit when, you know, your Doom Wheel has gone wild for the umpteenth time and is now squishing all your own troops, and your Bolt Lightning, your Lightning Zapper thing has misfired, and your Warp Fire Throwers have blown up, destroying the regiment that they're attached to. There comes a point where you think, okay, come on, can I just have some decent troops, please? But a lot of the time, I mean, it was just funny, you know, and so you'd have, you know, quite a good tactical game with a lot of challenges, but with some fun as well. Whereas I found that Guy's Dark Elves, the one thing they were not was funny. You know, some of their troops were a bit rubbish and sort of flimsy, but a lot of them were really horrible. And particularly the Dark Elf magic was really nasty, you know. And so they reached a point with the mini campaign with him where it was like, do you know what? I think I've had enough of playing against Dark Elves. I'm going to give it a break for a while. But there you are. So you did Warhammer Fantasy and stuff, and what other stuff did you do after that, Jonathan?
Well, I kind of gave up on all of that and fell in love with Battlefleet Gothic. I liked, you know, basically naval combat in space. I come from a family with a strong military background. Most of them serving in the Navy back to, well, I think we traced our family back to the 1720s or so here in America, but you name the conflict, I've had a family member in it, just about. So maybe that colored my interest, I don't know. But Battlefleet Gothic, fantastic game. I was sad when they stopped really kind of supporting it.
Yeah. Went over to is it still in Specialist Games?
I think so. I know they have the rules for free as a, you know, like a PDF download on their website or somewhere.
All right. Because there's another game that Games Workshop used to produce that I have been desperately trying to find called Manowar.
Yes.
And people have told me, oh, Henry, you really... Because I've not done a lot of naval gaming, and I want to find some pretty straightforward naval rules to add a naval aspect to some of the campaigns that I'm running so that people can pick up and grasp the rules really quickly. And lots of people said, oh, God, there was this game, Man of War, Henry. You really must try. But, of course, it's no longer in production. And I've had a devil of a job trying to find, you know, the Man of War rules. I mean, the ships are not a problem because I can obviously, you know, if necessarily make ships or use something else for the ships. But it's the rules themselves. So, but you've played this game, have you, Jonathan?
No, but one of the guys I game with has a lot of stuff from the golden age of Games Workshop. Things going back to Rogue Trader and First Edition, this and that. And he happens to have rules and errata and models and stuff for Man of War. He brought them in one time and it's amazing to flip through and to see everything. I guess now the closest equivalent you might be able to come to is Warhammer, you know, Historical Trafalgar, I guess.
Yeah, well, I've got a copy of that. But you know what? It's one of those things. I was sent a review copy, what was it, 2 years ago now, whenever it came out. And I gave it a quick read through. I mean, it's a beautiful book. I mean, have you got that, Jonathan, that book?
No, my group's going to be playing that soon. One of the guys, his name's Adrian. I think I mentioned him earlier in this episode. Yeah. He's really into naval combat as well. He ended up picking up the rule book for that, and he's slowly reading it, and he's going to teach us all how to play. But I haven't played it yet.
Well, the rule book itself is beautifully produced. It's gorgeous. And as a primer on kind of Age of Sail naval warfare, it's excellent, really excellent. The rules themselves, I gather, have proved somewhat controversial because naval wargaming is another one of those very specialist areas like air warfare gaming and stuff, where you can get some people who get quite hot under the collar if it's not done absolutely correctly, you know, with all the nautical terms and this, that and the other. Well, you know what it could be like, Jonathan. And I gather that it got a bit of a kicking from some people of this kind a little ago. But I think it's got a dedicated and loyal following because it was the first, you know, most sets of naval warfare rules that I've seen, you know, in my however many years it is now, 40 years of wargaming plus, are pretty grim affairs, you know, black and white, you know, typed up sheets with lots of statistics and difficult navigation things and all that naval jargon. Whereas the Trafalgar book was the first one I'd ever seen where I went, oh, okay, I get it, and explained everything really clearly. We in the way that everything that comes out of Games Workshop is done. You know, whatever you might think of Games Workshop, the quality of their publications is always superb.
Absolutely.
And very attractive. But I rushed out and I bought some rather lovely ships from two sources, quite expensively, from a chap called Rod Langton, who's over here in the UK, who produces the most exquisite tiny little ships with all their rigging and sails and stuff. They are phenomenal things, but my God, you need to have microscope eyes to put them together and not my big fat fingers, that's for sure. And then more recently, I discovered a company you probably heard of. They're an American company called GHQ,
who
also do the 1/300th scale micro armor that I love so much that you've seen in battle games. They produce a wonderful range, I discovered, again, of Age of Sail ships that are suitable for kind of 18th century and Napoleonic warfare, and they're much easier to put together. But the fact of the matter is, Jonathan, I got these in a big rush of enthusiasm, and they're still in their packets in a box on my shelf over there. Classic wargamer's disease. But one of these days, I promise, I really will get round to doing something about it. But there we are. But the Man of War rules, I was kind of interested in somehow managing to get hold of a copy to actually just read them, because I've had all these people saying, oh, yeah, fantastic, they're fantastic. And I've never actually played them. So there we are. The other thing I was going to ask you, so you started off with kind of board gaming and stuff. Did you ever get into the big simulationist games like Avalon Hill, Squad Leader, and that kind of stuff?
Do you know, I've seen them, but things of that detail kind of scare me off. I'm more of a casual kind of gamer. So the fact that I'm doing historicals, I guess, well, I mean, you may have been horrified when I told you that I had no intention of painting my historicals historically correct. Which I know is going to raise a few eyebrows out in the community. But
Jonathan, why would it raise my eyebrows? I'm a man who invents entire countries, as you well know.
That's true.
My whole imaginations things means that I can paint a uniform to be whatever I want it to be, and no one can sniff at it. So I'm hardly going to be horrified at you thinking, oh God, you know, I can't go through all the agonies of making sure that there's three buttons per cuff rather than two buttons, you know. Which is what lots of people do, you know. You haven't seen the half of it yet, Jonathan.
Oh, no,
I think.
Thank you.
I think you need to take a trip to, I don't know, there's probably guys like that at the big show over your way, Historicon,
yep.
Which happens each year. I'm sure you'll find plenty of button counters and people will say, oh, do you know what? The lace on that tricorn hat, Jonathan, that's not quite right. There should be three strands, not two.
I have a few choice words for that.
Exactly. And yes, we won't go there. But and also, there's a big debate, for example. You're doing the American Revolution, what I would, of course, call the American War of Independence. There's a historical argument right there, of course, for another time. But one of the countries, of course, that got involved was France.
Yep.
And the French, now this is fantastic, the French during the 18th century basically wore what you or I would look at and say, that's a white coat. Mm-hmm. But it's not. It's an off-white. And the pages and pages and volumes of argument about what particular shade of off-white it should be, because the color is actually called gris blanc, which is gray white, and should it be more gray than white or more white than gray? And the argument about this, there's a wonderful guy, because we're coming to a close, I'll give a shout out to someone. There's an American gentleman who I'm going to encourage to listen to your podcast. His name is Bill Protz, William B. Protz, who lives in Michigan State, I believe. And he is a middle-aged chap. He's very famous and famously knowledgeable about the Seven Years' War. Not just the Seven Years' War in America and Canada, but also the Seven Years' War in Europe. And he's written a set of rules, the name of which has just escaped my brain at the moment. But he's a very, very knowledgeable chap, and he often gets hot under the collar about the way, the particular shade of grey, or is it white, that people have painted their French figures. So, Jonathan, you think you started easily with the American Revolution. I can tell you there's a whole minefield out there that's just waiting for you to stumble into, and I'm sure that you have great joy with that. I was going to say, actually, you kind of moved into historical gaming. is it because you've been that interest has been triggered by the history, or is it the set of rules that's triggered that interest, or where do you think this is going to take you? Is it going to make you feel like, oh, actually, you're interested in actually researching and reading more about that period?
Well, I think it's a kind of a combination of everything. I mentioned how I have my college degree in politics and history, and I focused actually predominantly on colonial Northeastern America at the time. So I have a big interest in American Rev and everything leading up to that and, right after. So I guess that may have made it a little easier for me with Black Powder anyway to say, well, American Rev sounds like a lot of fun. But I also, and I'm going to use the term play, but play implies, playing regularly. but I play Flames of War. And
right.
That's like a whole nother, that's a whole nother everything, really. But yeah. Part of it is that I kind of, I guess, long ago realized, but never could put a name to it, the fact that I became disillusioned with non-historical wargaming. Part of it I blame on you, actually, because of reading Battle Oops. Games.
Oh, dear. Sorry.
You piqued my interest about all sorts of things. Because at first, I had stumbled across your magazine, and I was like, oh, Battle Games, this sounds interesting, but what game do they talk about? And I was like, oh, they talk about all sorts of games. And I was like, oh, that's cool. And then, honestly, I moved on until Tom was like, there's this magazine and it's awesome and you need to read it. It's called Battle Games. And I was like, Battle Games? Why does that sound familiar? And then, of course, I looked at it again and I said, well, this is actually a fantastic magazine. And, I'm going to give it a try because I love history and we'll see what happens in it. And then I'm reading about the Dark Ages and reading about Ancients and about this rule set and DBA and reviews of Napoleonics and everything. And I was like, well, this all looks really interesting. And I'm one of those people who, if something interests me, I need to become involved with it. So like you, that results in me doing far too many things that I have time for.
Yeah.
But I saw this and I was like, well, this is a good way for me to get into this new type of gaming and see if I like it. And I did. I find I like it so much that I don't foresee myself going back to things like Warhammer Fantasy or War Machine or 40K or any of that kind of stuff.
Well, that's interesting. So do you kind of feel like you graduated from that?
Yeah, I guess you could say I kind of grew up in a way. No offense to anyone who loves, War Machine and any of the other stuff, but it kind of went into a different direction and wanted a little more detail. But at the same time, I am a casual gamer. I'm not going to be someone who's going to spend, hours researching why a uniform has three buttons as opposed to two and, when they stop making that it's interesting, yeah, but I'd rather someone else to do that and write a book that I will then read and make accessible to me.
Yeah, and in a sense, it's coming full circle to, and it's probably a good way to wrap up, as you said, coming full circle, because Black Powder as a book is much closer to the kind of books that used to be written about wargaming that I was telling you about earlier. Mm-hmm. You know, the books by Charles Grant and Bruce Quarry and Don Featherstone and Terry Wise and these people where it contains a set of rules, but it also contains enough background material to help you to understand that particular period of history. It's got enough pictures to show you the kind of uniforms that were worn and that sort of stuff. There's enough there to really engage someone to get them started in the hobby.
Yes.
And this is because, as you know, I'm trying to finish off writing my own book, which in a sense probably isn't going to be massively dissimilar in some ways to Black Powder, because it just so happens that the set of rules that I've written to go in this book are horse and musket era rules, and it's going to have lots of background material and pictures and stuff. I think one of the things I'm probably going to dwell on slightly more is trying to advise a newcomer to wargaming, someone in this sense to historical gaming, such as yourself, Jonathan. And you're actually one of the people I've got in my mind as I'm writing, I can tell you.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely, because I think it's really important for a writer to decide, well, who is it I'm writing this book for? And you are one of the people I'm writing this book for, because you've got maybe some experience of gaming, perhaps not historical gaming. You have no preconceived ideas of what historical wargaming is all about and what, you know, how it's played and that kind of stuff. So you need advice on, you know, well, okay, where can I buy the figures? What scale should I choose? What manufacturers are out there? What sort of money? How should I budget this? You know, how should I plan building an army? How should I paint the figures? How should I assemble them into the regiments? You know, explain to me some of this stuff about scales and how we're actually representing the battles we're playing. And, oh, who were the major combatants? And, oh, I've got that far. Can I have a set of rules, please, so I can play a game? Sure, here's a set of rules. And, well, are you going to give me some advice about not just how to play the game, but how to do reasonably well in the game? In other words, please teach me something, at least, about tactics. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, what my book is about. I hope, you know, listening to that, you'll think, oh, that's ticking a few of your boxes anyway.
Well, it sounds like the type of book that I need to buy.
Well, there you go, Jonathan. Magnificent. You'll be my first customer. Anyway, Jonathan, I'm afraid I'm going to have to shove off, my dear fellow, because I've got other things to do this evening, and it's now gone 8:30 over here.
Oh, absolutely. But in the sense of wrapping up, if you could just let our listeners know how to find Battle Games Magazine and how they could contact you if they wish to subscribe or that sort of stuff.
Of course, Jonathan. Bless your heart. Right. Well, the simplest first step is please go to the Battle Games website, which is at www.battlegames.co.uk. I'm still very British. The truth is, actually, as a little footnote there, I did try to get the battlegames.com domain when I first launched my website, but I don't know if you remember, there was that awful movie that was made back in the 80s called Battle Games, and they still had the domain name, so hence I got battlegames.co.uk. So that's how you do that. If you want to email me, you can always email me at henry@battlegames.co.uk. UK. I also have a WordPress blog, which is what is it? WordPress. Where is it? WordPress.com. Oh, sorry. Beg your pardon. Scrub that, Jonathan.
Okay.
It's http://battlegames.wordpress.com. I always get that in the wrong order. The Battle Games bit comes first. You can find me on Twitter @battlegames. And also, I have a Facebook page now that seems to be becoming quite popular, facebook.com/battlegames. I think that's probably enough ways of getting hold of me, isn't it, Jonathan?
It sounds good to me.
Yeah, the bane of my life is the demand these days that, small businesses of all kinds have, pages on these various electronic media. And the trouble is, it's so time consuming just keeping them all up to date. But there we are. I am there. People will find me from time to time. All right.
Henry, thank you so much for making the time to be with us today. I was looking forward to this. This was a fantastic chance to chat with you, and I hope we can do it again soon.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a real pleasure, Jonathan. It really has. I mentioned at the top of the show that I've been kind of looking forward to finally getting to talk to you after all this time. It's been a real pleasure. And I think if I come on again, what I'll do is I will shut up and ask you lots of questions next time.
I'll have to get prepared for that.
Anyway, it's been a real pleasure, Jonathan. Thank you ever so much for having me on the show.
Thank you so much, Henry. Have a good evening.
Warning, warning. Coming up next is the Music to Game By segment in the CWF Gamecast. Please stay tuned. We'll be back after this song.
To be wearing some kind of futuristic armor. Pass me the can opener so I can try to get it out.
No, no, Major. That is an iPad.
Good Lord, man. Don't be daft. It'll never fit under my monocle.
No, Major. The iPad is just another device you can use to read Battle Games magazine, because it's available in digital form as well as on paper.
Digital? What's that? A magazine with fingers? Well, there's still too much newfangled stuff in here. All these tanks and Blitzkrieg Commander and plastic now. They seem to be condoning the replacement of good old-fashioned lead. This is outrageous.
Yes, but there's still plenty of good old-school content as well, like Command Challenges and even a smattering of Spencer Smith's, what?
Yes, true, and those maps are first-rate, and I've read some excellent book reviews and articles comparing rule sets and how to make things and interviews with some jolly interesting chaps. Well, I've got to admit, I've been converted, so get me a pigeon. I need to place an order. Converted? Excellent, Major. Committed, more like.
Come and visit the website at www.battlegames.co.uk, where you can find the magazine on paper for instant digital download or even on CD, so you can simply choose whatever suits you best. You could be downloading and reading your very first issue of Battle Games in just a matter of minutes, so why not give it a try? Battle Games, the spirit of wargaming.
The CWF Gamecast is proudly sponsored by 127games.com, home of the cheapest Axis and Allies miniatures. Find them at 12-7-games.com. And contest sponsor, Battle Games Magazine, the spirit of wargaming, available at fine hobby shops throughout the United Kingdom and beyond. Subscribe online at www.battlegames.co.uk. This recording is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-Alike 3.0 license. Look for the CWF Gamecast online at www.wargamingforums.com. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. You can learn more about this episode by reading the show notes on our blog. Thank you for listening, and keep on gaming.